Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you all to this afternoon's Walls Lecture, which is also the 20th Florence Mahoney Lecture. And let me begin by giving a little background for those of you who may not have known Florence. Florence Mahoney was a woman who played an enormous role in the history of NIH as an advocate who entertained whichever presidents or congresspersons appeared to be influenceable. And for her, that included just about everyone in the time, principally in the 1970s, 1960s, 70s, 80s. She had played a very focal role in many of the institutes, but in particular was largely responsible for the founding of NIA. Florence died about 5 years ago at the age of 103. She was born in 1899. And in addition to her advocacy, she had a voracious appetite for science and was always terribly excited about this lecture each year. In years when she was able, she would come and attend. In subsequent years, I would visit her at her home. She was always anxious to know who the scientist was, how rigorous the science was, and she would be most excited by this year's speaker. The tradition will remain to honor what she has done and what she represents. Equally pleased to introduce the speaker this year on this 20th year, Rick Morimoto, who will be known to many of you. First, his background briefly. Rick went to school at the University of Illinois in Chicago, then graduate school at the University of Chicago, did some postdoctoral work at Harvard before returning to Northwestern, where he is now, so far as I can tell by appointments, professor of almost everything, including biology, biochemistry, cell biology, and molecular biology, if that covers the titles, as well as director of the Rice Institute for Biological Sciences. His research has been seminal to the science of many of us, many of the institutes that span NIH, growing from a focus in heat shock proteins to the general topic of chaperones, which of course are critical to the surveillance, well-being, and censoring of all proteins through cells. His particular focus has been in the function of the chaperones and cells of the nervous system, so germane to neurodegenerative disorders, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, and ALS. And the talk which we'll present today will therefore span those interests, as you can see, titled Protein Misfolding in Aging and Neurodegenerative Diseases. Rick, it's a great pleasure to have you here.
Richard, thank you very much. Indeed, it's a great privilege and honor to give the Florence Mahoney Lecture. It's, for me, a great pleasure to be back at NIH. I've served many decades on study sections, on NAGMS Council, and have enjoyed, I think, the privilege of working together with many colleagues in many of the institutes. As Richard pointed out, my interests really started with much more fundamental basic science questions, starting with a group of people who in the late 70s discovered the heat shock response. At that time, it was thought that maybe this was something unique to Drosophila, that only fruit flies would sense a change in temperature and activate a set of genes which were then called heat shock proteins. It was a wonderful tool for molecular biology. Indeed, one of our colleagues next door is Carl Wu, known to many of you. Carl, myself, and many others, upon the cloning of the heat shock genes, realized this was a great opportunity to study transcription. Along the way, people would say, well, Rick, what do these proteins do, these heat shock proteins? And I think, as we've all learned over the past 15 years, these heat shock proteins are fascinating. They not only guide the folding, the translocation, the assembly, and therefore the disassembly of proteins, but they play a critical role in a process called protein homeostasis, literally ensuring that the cell senses the environment properly, knows how to respond, and in a sense protects that cell. The implications then for chaperones and the heat shock response in some of the most complex and most profound diseases, such as aging and neurodegenerative disease, then has become a focus of our research. Let's start really at the most basic level so we can come together. If one thinks then about the problem of protein folding, one starts with an unfolded polypeptide that emanates from the ribosome. This then can collapse into various intermediate folded states, and of course, if unperturbed, will then fold to the final native state. There is an equilibrium, one can roughly consider this as homeostasis, where the intermediates can go off pathway to form misfolded species, and both the misfolded species and the native polypeptides, of course, upon ubiquitin tagging, get destroyed by the proteasome or by other clearance mechanisms such as autophagy. Heat shock, of course, one of the most ancient forms of environmental and physiologic signals, shifts the equilibrium because heat shock changes the amount of folded polypeptides. It starts to denature proteins very much as if you've soft-boiled an egg. And it shifts the equilibrium, increasing the amount of misfolded polypeptides. But nevertheless, we know that organisms and cells can respond perfectly to this stress and maintain homeostasis by the balance of these pathways and clearance. The problem is that it's not just heat shock stress, it's not just transient stress. What one also has, for example, are various environmental conditions, the appearance of small molecules, both internal and external. And I think, as will be relevant to the major topic of this talk, pathophysiological states, that is, diseases, in particular dominant genetic diseases, associated with the expression of mutant and misfolded proteins. And how these interact with various other polymorphisms, of course, shifts the equilibrium on misfolded polypeptides. Even though the cell has the capacity to respond by expressing molecular chaperones, and I'll point out, and we'll get back to this at the end of the talk, it's not just one chaperone. Within the human genome, we encode 358 chaperones that fall into different gene families. These chaperones, of course, then ensure that polypeptides are properly folded, are chaperoned to the proteasome. But for reasons that we don't quite understand, the equilibrium is disrupted. Folding and clearance mechanisms are not in homeostasis, and protein aggregate species start to appear in the cell. Another way to look at this is in the following cartoon. I've told you about this equilibrium between unfolded, intermediate, and native, that this is part of a normal process of turnover and degradation. The problem, of course, when you have misfolded species is that they can be degraded, such as the cystic fibrosis CF transporter. Other proteins that are misfolded, for example, alpha-1 antitrypsin, is improperly trafficked. The result, of course, is the human disease emphysema. What we're particularly fascinated with are a class of misfolds that form toxic species. These are also called amyloid diseases, and they include Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease, ALS, and Alzheimer's disease. There's about 130 of these different human diseases which are related to protein conformation. So when I highlight these are really just representatives of what's likely to be a large and growing number of human diseases associated with protein misfolding. Where chaperones, of course, play a critical role is to prevent misfolding and to guide the native state. The relevance of this, I think, is quite obvious to everyone who's had a chance to reflect on neurodegenerative diseases, that whether it's Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, the prion diseases such as Creutzfeldt-Jakob, ALS, or the poly-Q diseases such as Huntington's disease, that in the neuropathological samples analyzed by histochemistry, one can find these appearances of these aggregates and Lewy bodies and plaques, and that these all originate from proteins when studied in vitro form these very ordered fibrils, usually cross beta sheet or parallel beta sheet structures. And what I'm going to concentrate on is how misfolded proteins and aggregates cause molecular stress and interfere with cellular function. Actually, last night on CNN, there was an entire section related to recent information from the Alzheimer's Disease Association, indicating that over the past 5 years, there was a 10% increase in the frequency, if I remember, in Alzheimer's disease. So these diseases, the neurodegenerative diseases as a collective, are unfortunately a growing and large population worldwide. They result in the selective loss or dysfunction of neurons. They're all aging associated. They have dementia, loss of motor control, and unfortunately, they're all fatal. I think the most, what makes them most daunting is that to date, we have very few, if any, therapeutics for these types of protein misfolding diseases. I'd like to concentrate for the purpose of this talk on one example, that of Huntington's disease, which is a polyglutamine disease. There are 9 different diseases where within the normal protein, in this case Huntington, there is a stretch, a CAG, which is the triplet codon for glutamine. There is an expansion such that in the wild type gene, the expansion is small, and when the expansion occurs, in this case from 19 to 82, the protein, as shown here, transfected into neurons, goes from a soluble state within the cell body and the processes to the appearance of these puncta, or aggregates. What's striking about this transformation at the biochemical level is how it correlates very precisely with the clinical phenotype. So shown in this table is, I think, the very striking transition as one increases the length of polyglutamine. And you can see that the transition is in the mid-30s, where individuals who carry an expansion of polyglutamine within their Huntington protein now develop Huntington's disease. Shown below is a sort of a visual description of the distribution of CAG repeats in individuals who do not have HD. And you can see that while the average is about 19, that the distribution is really from 10 residues to the mid-30s. But as the expansion occurs at the mid-30s and beyond, what one gets is a very striking inverse relationship between the average age of onset, such that individuals with an expansion of 40 glutamines will have an average age of onset of 55, an expansion of 45 will have an average age of onset of 45. The pink region shown behind is a reflection of the variance, that is, the other genetic modifiers that are affecting the actual time at which disease occurs, bringing, I think, to light the importance of thinking about modifiers. I think we all know that for each of these different diseases, that there are many different ways that one can study the process. Very elegantly, one can study these proteins in vitro, from which studies on the elegant beta structure, the cross beta sheets, have been discovered. You can look at them in a variety of neuronal and non-neuronal tissue culture lines. And then you have your various model systems. Mouse, of course, transgenic mice expressing these various proteins in their mutant form are well established, giving varied phenotypes. What's, I think, been most striking and dramatic for the field of neurodegenerative disease, and I think broader to protein misfolding diseases, has been non-vertebrate model systems. That you could use yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, C. elegans, or Drosophila, as a genetic discovery tool. Now, this may be unique to diseases of protein conformation because, indeed, how proteins are folded, how they're cleared, is unquestioned a very ancient and conserved process. So I'm going to concentrate on the models that we've developed in C. elegans. So shown here is an example. If one takes, for example, the toxic species in polyglutamine diseases, that is the polyglutamine stretch, with little else, and connects that to YFP or any other fluorescent proteins, expresses them by as transgenic lines in muscle cells or neurons, you can see very quickly this beautiful length-dependent appearance of aggregates, both in the muscle cell and in neurons. This aggregation toxicity is length-dependent and age-dependent. For those who are less familiar with how worms look, what you're looking at is an animal expressing below threshold Q19. One can quantify the motility compared to the effects of expressing the Q82, shown here. So not only can you see the very clear appearance of these aggregates, but the effect is quite dramatic. It's a gain-of-function toxicity that we've created, in a sense, in an invertebrate model system. What I'm showing you here is the expression of a single length, polyglutamine 40, in the entire nervous system of C. elegans. This is actually what's called the nerve ring. For those who are less familiar, C. elegans has 959 cells, of which 302 are neurons. What makes it great fun from a biochemist, biophysicist perspective is the animal is transparent always, which means that one could take, for example, polyglutamine YFP, express it throughout in all the nervous system, and then use fluorescence recovery after photobleaching. So if, for example, we take a particular neuron expressing Q40, we can photobleach it and look at the recovery of the signal, which you can quantify here, or you can look at another neuron, in this case the ventral cord neurons. You can photobleach it, and as I think you can all see, the image never recovers. One can then sample throughout the entire nervous system in the living animal to ask what is the basis of neuronal cell type specificity. And I'm showing you this result because for the first time, we now see only at the threshold of polyglutamine expansion. So remember, the threshold's about Q35 to Q40. We now see certain neurons where the protein's aggregated, shown here, and other neurons, sensory neurons, where the protein's absolutely soluble, arguing that really the basis for cell type specificity must have a genetic basis that we can get towards, and I'll address this later on. So one of the real questions then that all of these studies, and collectively studies from all the other diseases bring us towards, is why are aggregation-prone proteins deleterious to the cell? And I think the common hypothesis has been this idea of toxic gain of function, that the inhibitory effects of misfolded species on other proteins affect their cellular processes, and that some of this might be related to sequestration, that you can associate the polyglutamine, or let's say the mutant SOD, with other key proteins that regulate transport, signaling, mitochondrial function, transcription, folding, or clearance. So we decided to pose the question, could aggregation-prone proteins interfere globally? In other words, is there a general mechanism where the expression of a single aggregation-prone protein interferes overall with protein homeostasis? And because it affects overall folding and clearance mechanisms, could be a basis for progressive loss in cell function and cell death. So we searched for this idea of folding sensors. And you could imagine that one could develop perhaps biophysics sensors using fluorescence resonance energy transfer or various other methods to look at molecular interactions. We decided to take a purely genetic approach, realizing that one of the advantages of C. elegans, flies, and yeast is the ability to do genetics, and that one of the best characterized folding sensors are proteins with temperature-sensitive mutations. The functionality of a TS mutation, therefore, reflects the balance between metastability of a TS mutation and folding and clearance of this protein at different temperatures. And I think all of you can appreciate that the use of TS has been really the basis of figuring out many genetic pathways and much of what we understand about lineage in C. elegans. So for example, if we take a TS mutation within the helical region of paromyosin, one can find, for example, at the permissive temperature, the paromyosin folds properly and the worms are healthy. But at the restrictive temperature of 25 degrees, the paromyosin misfolds, the muscle structure does not form, and the embryo is dead. Completely dead. if you look at the phenotype as a function of temperature for any particular temperature-sensitive mutation, you can see at the restrictive temperature, you have 100% lethality, at the permissive, very little, and there is a very striking temperature relationship. It's very much like a folding transition, that is, the activity of a protein at different temperatures. So we decided to do then a series of genetic crosses. We take, for example, any number of now 11 different temperature-sensitive mutations that have very clear penetrance. We know that the polyglutamine alone at the permissive temperature has no lethality. The worms are healthy. You can see them here. And we now do the cross between the Q40 or Q35, the intermediate length, and the temperature-sensitive mutations. And the result's really quite dramatic. And this is really the take-home message for the first part of the talk, that if in these worms expressing a temperature-sensitive mutation, you now co-express the polyglutamine at the threshold, you find complete lethality at the permissive temperature. So the effect of the polyglutamine essentially is dropping the temperature by 10 degrees. It's having a huge effect on homeostasis. So the poly-Q really exposes the folding defect at the permissive temperature. Let me show you a little bit more of the data. Again, at the restrictive temperature, you can see that you get 100% lethality. In animals expressing YFP alone, there's no effect on paramycin. At Q24, which is below threshold, no effect. Q35, we now get 30% lethality at the permissive temperature. And at Q40, we now are at 50% lethality. Now, this is not just the expression of a polyglutamine in a muscle cell with a temperature-sensitive protein. We get the same results if we now express the polyglutamine in neurons and look at the effect on a neuronal temperature-sensitive protein. So the TS protein in this case is dynamin, which is an essential protein for the transport of vesicles in neurons. Again, this shows you the very nice penetrance of the mutation at the restrictive temperature of 28 degrees. Q19 below threshold has no effect. If we now express in neurons the Q40 together with the dynamin TS, which you now get 100% lethality at 15 degrees. So this really gives us a sense. And by the way, it makes no difference with tissue. We find the same results with any number of TS mutations. What's important here as a genetic experiment is that the toxicity occurs only when the TS mutants are co-expressed with the polyglutamine. We never see the toxicity when you cross two temperature-sensitive mutations against each other or a temperature-sensitive against a non-essential null mutation. I'm going to show you one more result and give you a sense for what we think are some explanations for this. Now, is it really misfolding? This shows you an immunohistochemistry of paramycin at the permissive temperature, and I think you can see very nicely the striations of the myofilament structure in the muscle cells. At the restrictive temperature, what one gets is misfolding, at least mistargeting, and misassembly of the myofilament structure. You get these paracrystalline arrays. If you make an extract from the cells at 15 or 25 degrees and do a partial proteolysis analysis, now probe the Western blot with an antibody against paramycin. This is, in a sense, a proxy for the folded state. You can see from the fragmentation patterns of the paramycin at 15 compared to 25 degrees that they're non-identical, consistent with our proposal that at 25 degrees it's misfolded. Now, what happens when we look at the distribution of paramycin in animals expressing the polyglutamine? And that's shown here. I think you can see quite clearly that at 15 degrees, the distribution of paramycin looks nothing like it does normally. In fact, it looks very similar to the paramycin paracrystalline arrays at the restrictive temperature. But what was dramatic was when we then turned on the microscope and looked at the appearance of the polyglutamine in the same cells, you notice that in the overlay, that where the green is, which is the polyglutamine, and the red, which is the paramycin, they aren't coincident. This actually starts to rule out the simplest hypothesis that the polyglutamine acts as a seed onto which the paramyosin misfolds and then assembles. Our results don't rule out the possibility of very small microseeds, but it says it's not as simple as just gross aggregation on the polyglutamine. And moreover, when we look at the Western blot of the extract from these cells, you can see that the fragmentation pattern looks very similar. So I think these results start to tell us then that it's really about a disruption of protein homeostasis reflected by the loss of function of any number of temperature-sensitive mutations only when you express the mutant polyglutamine. We get the same results, for example, with RAS. I'm not going to go into the results in any detail. These experiments are interesting because RAS is expressed everywhere throughout the worm, but there are different phenotypes depending on whether you look at muscle cells or you look at neurons. In both cases, what happens is you get the toxicity only in the muscle cell or the neuron when the polyglutamine is expressed in the same cell as the temperature-sensitive mutant. The polyglutamines by themselves have no effect on RAS function. So we can conclude from this that these aggregation-prone proteins, polyglutamine, reveals the RAS phenotype at the permissive temperature. The enhanced toxicity is cell autonomous. That is, loss of function in neuronal cells does not cause overt loss of function throughout the animal. So it's not as if the animal is entirely sick. And it really starts to suggest a basis for cell type specificity, that aggregation-prone proteins, particularly poly-Q, it's enhanced by the expression of other metastable proteins. In other words, the surprise is that protein polymorphisms are potent modifiers of these aggregation-prone proteins. One more surprise. We can then ask the question, what is the effect of the TS mutation on the aggregation state of the polyglutamine? What I'm showing you is a set of experiments where you're looking just at the level of aggregation in Q40 homozygotes. This is a Q40 heterozygote. Here's the quantitation of aggregates below. If one now has just the single paramyosin TS mutation or the single RAS mutation, I think you can see quite clearly that aggregation toxicity is enhanced, actually quite dramatically, by the expression, in this case, of just one more metastable protein. And overall, this reveals the delicate state of folding homeostasis. So let me sort of put it in a simple sense. Imagine that we're doing an inorganic chemistry titration experiment that probably all of us were forced to do. And you're titrating in a solution, and you're waiting for the system to turn color, right? It's a titration. Normally, the temperature-sensitive mutations, the protein polymorphisms that exist in our genome, are buffered by the capacity of molecular chaperones and other folding catalysts. But if into the reaction one adds one of these dominant aggregation-prone proteins, it literally soaks up 95% of the buffering capacity. And now the system senses one more misfold, one at a time. Now, this is not just a case of polyglutamine alone. What I want to show you is that we get literally the same results with another model, in this case related to familial ALS, where we've created an ALS model for in C. elegans. What you're looking at here is the expression of wild-type SOD in embryos, or the G85R mutation. You can see all these little aggregates. Here, if we now express with paramyosin temperature-sensitive mutation, these embryos are completely dead. It's amazing. And you can see this at the permissive temperature, whether the G93A mutation by itself or the G85R or together with the paramyosin mutation, we're at 80 to 100% penetrance at the permissive temperature. What this starts to suggest then is that there may be a commonality of many of these different aggregation-prone proteins in their ability to titrate homeostasis. So within the genomes of different organisms, I think let's think about it from the human perspective, there are polymorphisms that result in mild folding variants, but because of the capacity of the cellular protein folding clearance quality control machinery, these mild folding variants are properly folded and the cell and organism functions properly. problem is the following. If in that same genome one has an expansion of polyglutamine or a mutation in SOD1, you now generate a chronic aggregation-prone protein. This chronic aggregation-prone protein overwhelms the folding clearance apparatus such that these mild folding variants are misfolded. I've shown you this genetically for a number of different proteins. And the consequence then is that we think that the disease is not just because of a simple aggregation or loss. It's a combination of loss of function globally of proteins that are conformationally challenged together with the consequences of aggregation-prone proteins. So is there a simple way to explain these kinds of results? There's no simple way, but I'm going to try to at least give you a way of how to think about this level of complexity. Molecular chaperones are a very curious set of proteins. They guide the folding of most other proteins in the cell. Each of these different rounds, the circles correspond to HSP90 or HSP70 or small heat shock proteins. We know, for example, that HSP70 regulates the folding and translocation of most proteins to the endoplasmic reticulum and to the mitochondrion. They also play a critical role in the folding of both generalized proteins as well as specialized clients such as kinases, phosphatases, and many signaling proteins. We know that the same chaperones play a critical role to prevent proteins from misfolding. And needless to say, chaperones are critical when proteins become ubiquinated to bring them to the proteasome for degradation. My point then is that one has a very simple class of proteins that permeate all aspects of cell biology. So what happens to that cell if it now expresses polyglutamine proteins such as Huntington? So we and others have shown in the past that, in fact, the chaperones love these aggregates, these misfolded species, and they become very closely associated with them. But what's interesting is that they're not sequestered irreversibly. They're functionally associated. That is, the chaperones are binding and releasing as if this is a substrate. And the consequence, of course, is that there's no HSP70 for translocation or folding or export or import. Another analogy. So let's imagine that on a floor in Building 37, in a tea room, someone puts 100 pizzas. Some very generous PI donates 100 pizzas. Okay, so we all know what the tendency of all researchers are. In particular, graduate students and fellows, will become functionally sequestered at the location of the pizzas. And they will be happily eating the pizzas, leaving unchaperoned their experiments at the bench. Well, if this happens in the cell, we're in trouble. That's fine to just get pizza. But it really is a competition between very simple molecules, and the chaperones are just going to a substrate, the polyglutamine proteins or these SOD growing aggregates, as if it's a substrate. So what we think is going on is that there's a collapse of protein homeostasis initiated by these aggregation-prone proteins, that the global disruption of homeostasis offers a new hypothesis to explain the diversity of downstream cellular targets. By the way, I don't argue in this that other explanations, other mechanisms are also not valid. But here's a very simple one, where the sequestration of chaperones can obviously interfere with mitochondrial function. It can obviously interfere with the translocation into the endoplasmic reticulum. And we call this a chaperone titration model to explain the downstream consequences. It also, I think, offers an interesting insight. I did tell you that in humans we have 358 chaperones. They're not all expressed in every cell at the same time. And it's inevitable that they correspond to different arrays of chaperones expressed in different cells, and that aging itself has an interesting consequence. Now, why are these protein conformational diseases enhanced by aging? Let's go back to the use of these temperature-sensitive mutations. Again, our folding sensors. What I'm showing you is the phenotype of paramyosin or RAS just as a function of aging. There's no temperature shift. This is all done at the permissive temperature. And shown in green here for paramyosin is the loss of function of paramyosin just as a consequence of aging. Shown here in neurons is the loss of function of RAS just as a consequence of aging. Now, what's interesting is, well, what's important about this particular time in the aging and development of a worm? This is after they have generated all their progeny, post-replicative. So there are no more progeny being made by C. elegans, and it's almost as if they've kicked in this very rapid loss of protein homeostasis. This looks very daunting, right? Because, and we've done this now for many different proteins, they all lose their functionality approximately the same point. Fortunately, we can genetically modify this. If, for example, we knock down the age 1 pathway, this is the insulin-like signaling pathway, we can suppress the toxicity. If we knock out heat shock transcription factor, which of course is upstream of chaperones, we enhance toxicity. Likewise, if we knock out DAF16, which is downstream of age 1, we can enhance toxicity. And if we mess with both of these stress-activated factors, you can see that you can basically kill the animals, which tells us then that these genetic networks play a huge role in modulating this age dependence. This effect is really quite traumatic. This just shows you again the effect of the RAS temperature-sensitive mutation as a function of aging. If we now overexpress heat shock transcription factor in a tissue-specific manner, the effect is really quite dramatic. We go from a 50% loss of function at about day 5 to a 50% loss of function at about day 10. We've really pushed back quite dramatically when proteins lose functionality just as a consequence of aging. So what this really tells us is that HSF and the lifespan modulators, AGE1 and DAF16, really orchestrate the folding capacity of the cell and are essential to maintain homeostasis during aging. Now, I've started this story by telling you about polyglutamines, so this leaves open the question, what happens to the polyglutamines as animals age? And the result is the same. What you're looking at is the head of a C. elegans expressing threshold Q35. The black region in the middle is the intestine. You're looking at expression in body wall muscle cells. If you look at the head of the same animal at day 7 or day 10, I think it's obvious to all that you have aging-dependent appearance of polyglutamine aggregates. One can quantify this very strikingly in animals expressing Q29, where there's no appearance of aggregates, Q33, 35, or Q40 and Q82. And likewise, if you now take these animals where there's this dramatic loss of function due to the polyglutamine, and now just by genetics or by RNAi achieve longevity, you can see that we have a huge increase in suppression of toxicity by enhancing longevity. So what these results really start to tell us then is that we can manipulate aggregation toxicity by just influencing the lifespan genes of C. elegans. Now, what happens if we now manipulate HSF levels in animals expressing polyglutamine? Just to remind you, Q29 is soluble, Q40 is at the threshold, and above that you get aggregates. We were very intrigued by this idea of whether this is set in stone or modulatable. So if we suppress heat shock factor, you can see that we can increase quite dramatically aggregation load. If we now overexpress heat shock factor, you can see we go from animals where we get profound aggregation in the muscle cells to where much of the aggregation is suppressed, and actually the protein becomes soluble. We really shifted the folding kinetics and therefore solubility, and just by manipulating HSF levels. This really suggests then that HSF plays a critical role, sort of as a master regulator. Is HSF then a master regulator of aging? Now, by the way, this was an intriguing experiment for us to do, because when we had first characterized heat shock factor, we realized that this is a heat shock factor, right? And so it's a factor that's required when you stress cells. From our perspective, it never occurred to us that aging was such a profound stress. And I'm just going to show you a summary of the results to remind you, of course, that we're talking about the insulin signaling pathway. For many of you, you see your favorite proteins. AKT is upstream of many pathways. Of course, PI3 kinase, FOXO3, or DAF16. Mutations upstream lead to longevity. You see the results here quite dramatically. If you have a single mutation leading to lifespan enhancement, age 1, you have a 35 to 50% increase in lifespan. If we now knock down age 1 by HSF RNAi or DAF16, we now literally go all the way down to animals that have an average lifespan of 18 days. So it's a profound effect. And this argues that HSF is essential for insulin-dependent longevity. So what I've told you then is how we've thought about polyglutamine aggregation, its relationship to organismal toxicity, that it is not just alone the appearance of these aggregates that result in toxicity, but as we propose, that the imbalance that occurs when these aggregation-prone proteins are expressed has global inhibitory effects on other proteins with mild folding defects, or what I call metastable proteins. But the good news is that manipulation of lifespan regulators or stress responses, heat shock, can actually suppress every one of these and shift, I think, the equilibrium back to homeostasis. So a way to think about this complexity is that as a function of aging, one has then a collapse of protein homeostasis, that is correlated then with a loss of cell function. I'm not talking about frank cell death. I'm really talking about cellular dysgenesis, when proteins are not properly transported, they're not folded, they're not cleared. Of course, what I've shown you is that the system that sets this crossover point is really homeostasis, the networks of chaperones and clearance machines, and that if one now expresses these damaged proteins, all one does is we shift it. And of course, that is counterbalanced by an imbalance in protein homeostasis. And as I'll talk about near the end, this of course opens up very exciting strategies for therapeutics. Could one, for example, shift the equilibrium by rebalancing homeostasis? We've done many genetic screens, and I'm only going to show you one set of results. But one of the advantages of C. elegans, its transparency, the fact that the worms are whatever color we wish to make them, is that we can do very high-throughput genetic screens. I'm not sure that all of you are familiar with one of the acute advantages of the worm. Julie Erringer, based on Andy Fire's observations, had genetically engineered E. coli to express basically the entire genome as open reading frames. These bacteria now express each of the genes as double-stranded RNA. Worms eat bacteria as their sole food source. This method of feeding RNAi then magically allows the RNA as double-stranded RNA to be transmitted throughout the organism and literally to knock down that corresponding gene in the various tissues. It allows then very high throughput rapid screening. We've identified nearly 300 genes that enhance or suppress polyglutamine aggregation. We've also done forward genetic screens to look for modifiers, and modifiers that affect neurons and non-neuronal cells, and small molecule screens. I think you get the point that we feel that homeostasis is not a terribly robust system. It's actually very delicately balanced. The ability to do genetic screens gives us a way to test how delicate is the composition of the genes that control homeostasis. Expression of polyglutamine, or SOD, of course, causes an aggregation load and toxicity load. I've already shown you that one can now rebalance the system very nicely using master regulators such as heat shock transcription factor or the AGE1 DAF16 system. So when we did a screen, in this case an enhancer screen, we identified about 186 genes that enhanced polyglutamine. They fell into five major classes. I think the surprise was we got many of the key proteins in transcription and processing. We got most of the ribosome and key factors. By the way, that's counterintuitive. This is an enhancer screen. We're very intrigued by what is it that prevents aggregation, and therefore the knockdown leads to premature aggregation. So why should a knockdown of ribosomal components lead to enhanced aggregation? You could imagine that for a suppressor, knocking out protein synthesis, of course, would prevent the expression of polyglutamine, but that's not what I'm talking about. Protein folding, protein transport, and protein degradation. In a sense, these are the major machines that one can define as protein homeostasis, that it starts with the process of transcription, goes all the way to clearance. Here's an interesting surprise. There are 238 chaperones in C. elegans. We only get three families. We get two HSP70s, one J domain protein, and we get the entirety of what's called the cytoplasmic chaperonin, CCT. Now, the cytoplasmic chaperone is interesting because it is a beta sheet specialist. It likes to bind to beta sheets, and in other studies that we and others have published, it turns out that CCT shifts the equilibrium of Huntington towards soluble species. We then did a suppressor screen. We identified 80 genes. It turns out these genes have an 80% overlap with suppression of mutant SOD in worms. This is intriguing because you'll remember earlier I showed you that both polyglutamine and SOD caused a collapse of protein homeostasis in genetic experiments. Here in a genetic screen, we're finding an overlap in suppressors, really suggesting that proteins that are very different, share nothing in common in terms of sequence, nevertheless must be affecting the same processes in the cell. What's interesting in this screen is that we find that some of the genes that suppress aggregation decrease toxicity. You'd say, well, that's good. That's a good suppressor screen. Some of them increase toxicity. And that's intriguing because we would propose that since we screen for aggregation conversion to soluble, that if we indeed converted to a more toxic, let's say, oligomeric state, we would see less aggregation but enhanced toxicity. And this we're very excited about from this genetic screen. So what I've told you about is really this relationship between the cellular challenge and cellular toxicity, and that there's a decrease in chaperone activity associated with aging and chronic stress. Under good times, the balance of chaperones and the proteasome activity keep everything in check. Misfolded proteins, they prevent toxic species from accumulating, and they prevent metastable proteins from affecting the cell. But as one ages and increases the level of stress in the system, the proteasome, of course, becomes less efficient because it can't clear these proteins. The levels of chaperones now become titrated, and all of a sudden, aggregation takes off. Proteins become sequestered, and as I showed you genetically, polymorphisms become revealed. This, of course, is exciting because it really gives a sense of how one might think about commonalities in these different misfolding diseases and develop therapeutic strategies trying to enhance HSF or chaperone networks. In the last three slides, I just want to give you a sense of where are we going on all of this. So we even coined a term, the All Chaperone Project. We even have the URL for this. In worms are 238 chaperones. It becomes essential to understand the genomic organization and evolution of all of them, not just of HSP70. To understand the expression during development, aging, and response to the multitude of stress responses, to understand the basis of chaperone network substrate specificity, and of course, to determine structure function. Imagine if we understood the structure function, and in particular the structure of the chaperones of a single organism, it becomes possible to even engineer chaperones to have altered specificities. Could one make chaperones, for example, that don't release A-beta, that don't release Huntington, that now bind to them, and because they're customized, have a ubiquitin tag to allow proteolysis? You might ask, well, hasn't this all already been done? And here's the surprise. We don't know the patterns of expression for any chaperones in any tissues of any organism. We never did it. But it's time now, I think, that it becomes an essential. Let me give you why it becomes intriguing. I'll just show you a little bit of data. Of the HSP70s, there are 11 of them in the worm. Five of them are in the endoplasmic reticulum, five are in the cytoplasm and nucleus, one's in the mitochondrion. We now start to understand the tissue specificity. Here's a ER chaperone, HSP70, called BIP. It's only expressed in the intestine at this level of resolution. Here's two different cytoplasmic HSP70. One is expressed in the hypodermis and the intestine. Here's an HSP70. It's as ancient as it gets, and it's only expressed in the pharynx of the worm. And these 70s are conserved throughout. So obviously, tissue specificity is going to be very important in understanding the network of molecular chaperones. At the regulatory level, you could imagine then chaperones are going to be an interesting regulatory network. They would respond to SCN1 or NRF2, DAF16, which of course is tied into metabolic regulation, and heat shock factor, which is tied into protein folding homeostasis. And together, these are probably some of the most interesting determinants related to longevity. Shown here are just a cartoon in different colors for each of these factors upstream of each of the HSP70 genes. I'm not going to go over it, but it's quite obvious that the pattern of expression, the inducibility, is going to sort. So you not only have tissue specificity, but you have stress-responsive specificity. I imagine that as we sort through this and for the other 238 chaperones, that we might start to understand the basis of a code. Let me give you an idea of how complex this is going to be. A lot of numbers here. First is just the number of genes in organisms from humans to Pombe. Let's go all the way to the back. 137 chaperones in Cerevisiae, 356 in humans. Here's worms at 238. What one finds is that they're basically all conserved. There's gene duplication as we go up to the humans in certain co-chaperone families, such as the cyclophilins, the FKBP proteins, some of the BAG proteins, but that most of the key chaperones are almost identical in gene number. Is there a chaperone code? So what do I mean by that? Will the chaperones that are expressed, for example, in specific neurons in worms share a similarity with the chaperones that are expressed in different parts of the mouse brain? You might say that's ridiculous. Perhaps. We'll see. Is there a code that's more similar? I'm not saying a precise code, but you can imagine that the worm muscle cell, in terms of its functionality, is certainly going to be quite similar to the muscle cell, skeletal muscle cell of a mouse or a human, because they still have to use myofilaments, assemble, disassemble, and utilize ATP. So is the code conserved? And I think where it becomes very relevant to the idea of can you manipulate this as it relates to human disease is that before we manipulate it, we have to know what's expressed. We need to know what chaperones are in different parts of the vertebrate brain before we ask questions of, well, is that the basis of a risk factor? So I've told you about our thinking about global consequences of misfolded proteins. I've integrated that with our thinking about stress and longevity. We think then that these aggregation-prone proteins really cause the global collapse of protein homeostasis. and that this offers a way to think about many different misfolded protein diseases. Neurodegenerative disease is certainly one of the most daunting, but metabolic diseases, other amyloid diseases such as adult onset diabetes, also have these commonalities. The identification of nearly 300 genes that now start to define homeostasis, of course, offers an approach to network analysis, not only at the expression level, but in terms of tissue specificity. And indeed, I think it is very intriguing that the genes that are involved in regulating folding, misfolding, also happen to be many of the key pathways that have been shown by many others to be essential for lifespan. And with that, I want to thank the people in my laboratory that did the work that I had a pleasure to share with you. Jim Morley and Heather Brignall, together with Sanjeev Satyal, developed all the C. elegans models in my laboratory. They're all graduate students. Many of them have gone on to postdocs now. Anat Ben-Zvi and Tali Gadalovitz are both postdocs who developed the temperature-sensitive protein homeostasis model. Susanna Garcia, Sue Fox, were involved in the genetic screens that I described. And it's a particular pleasure to end by thanking the NIH. I've been very fortunate to have many years of support from NIGMS, National Institutes of Aging, and NINDS, a number of other private foundations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick. We have time for questions now. I ask people to step up to the microphones. Let me start by asking one question that we discussed a bit. When you talked about possible implications for therapeutic intervention, one that you mentioned just a short bit ago, the possibility of actually engineering to alter the target specificities of chaperones is one which a priori makes sense. But we spoke a little about an alternative approach about the implications of regulating the levels of chaperones which are multispecific and the likelihood of achieving a therapeutic effect without disrupting overall homeostasis in a non-constructive manner.
Right. At first cut, it seems that it would be very difficult to manipulate protein homeostasis by something as fundamental as chaperone networks. And I probably would not have been as optimistic, except for the following bits of facts. Well, I think many people are familiar with the proteasome inhibitors, Valclade. Turns out every proteasome inhibitor is the most potent activator of the heat shock response. So you have huge amounts of HSF and chaperones being expressed in patients on these inhibitors for multiple myeloma. Second drug, galdanamycin, came out of NCI. Also already in clinical trials, if not in patients. Galdanamycin is an inhibitor of HSP90. It's a potent activator of heat shock factor and chaperones. And the third is that if any of you have taken non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or salicylates, it turns out every non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug activates heat shock transcription factor. Hugely, not a little. So I think, you know, and then the compound that we had worked on called celestrol, which is a potent activator of heat shock factor, comes out of Chinese herbal medicine. And you look at the indications for these things, and they give it for all types of stuff. So I'm wondering if this idea of rebalancing homeostasis has been really part of folk medicine, and it's just being rediscovered. So I think it's counterintuitive. I would not have expected it could work. But obviously, patients are on these already, which means that maybe you could develop it more specifically, not just for cancer, but to rebalance the system.
So, Rick, that was a terrific talk. I have a couple of questions. Your titration explanation, it sounds, going one way, it makes a lot of sense to me. So it makes sense that the length of the polyglutamine proteins would unmask the TS phenotype. But how does the titration model, when you're expressing a normal protein, presumably from its normal promoter, how do you imagine the probably smaller amounts of TS protein titrating away enough chaperones to allow the polyglutamine to aggregate.
So Dave, maybe let me restate it a little bit. I think I wasn't as clear. It's the SOD or the polyglutamine protein as it forms these misfolded species that now starts to functionally sequester the chaperones, which are required to keep that temperature-sensitive mutant functional.
No, I understand, but you right. also showed that by putting in a TS mutation, right, that the polyglutamine, so it's only because they aggregate.
Right.
But what about, like, the RAS-TS? Does the RAS-TS?
During aging.
Right.
Oh, during aging, we don't know the molecular basis of the phenomena that I described to you. We see at the permissive temperature, as you saw, the complete loss of function. Whether, I don't know what's going on. I mean, I doubt that it's as simple as the loss of HSP70 at day 7 of aging. I'm more expecting it's going to be a reduction in, you know, there's 250 genes involved in homeostasis. What if 20% of them are affected 5%? We don't even have detection tools to see this kind of change, but that may be the basis of aging. That, you know, you reduce this chaperone by 5%, this one by 10%, and it's all below our ability to measure. We're doing the experiments right now, sort of aging-related proteomics, or proteomics of aging cells in the worm. So, yeah.
I guess, basically, I had a question whether on a scale, you could estimate where polyglutamine would fall in the overall range of ability to sequester heat shock proteins for any, for example, misfolded protein that you might overexpress in the cell.
Okay, so I guess your question is, can one look at all the different protein misfolding models and start to assess which ones interact more avidly with chaperones like HSP70. No one's done that. That's a hard thing to quantify. It's an interesting question because one might imagine that of the protein misfolding diseases, that some might be much more effective in interactions with chaperones than others. I'm not sure how to do that experiment yet because it requires an ability to quantify, you know, actual numbers of molecules.
Do you have a guess, like a maximum, like a, you know, really bad, you know, something?
I can't hear you over the reverb.
Sorry. I guess the question is, do you have a feel for a specific protein that would be much worse than polyglutamine, for example?
Something oh, yeah.
That would
oh,
max
okay.
out
okay. Sure,
max
sure.
out the system that
yeah.
would be, which protein would that be?
The worst things we've ever put into a worm are tau mutations and the what's called the NM region of yeast prions. These are terrifying, what it does to the worm. So if our model holds true, those would now generate species that are going to sequester on a molar basis even more chaperones. We haven't done the experiment. Yeah.
Excuse me. Thank you very much for a nice presentation. You showed that polyglutamine mutant is temperature sensitive with a difference of 10 degree variation. So my question is that if a person who how do you link these studies to the humans living in Arizona and Alaska or when they traveled back and forth, so whether the polyglutamine mutation may?
Interesting question. I'm not sure. I think it's intriguing to wonder if you're at the equator or in Greenland, whether your ambient temperature could affect this. I think it's more related to the protein polymorphisms within the genome of an individual, and that those polymorphisms, I would predict, are modifiers. You could imagine that a polymorphism in different proteins are not going to be equal in their effect on misfolding. Some might get readily cleared as a ubiquitin tagged and then degraded species. Others may simply misfold and now start interfering with the process. So, which reminds me, Dave, I now understand your question.
Thank you.
We'll talk about it later. Yes.
Two last questions. Are those people
already at the microphones?
Is there any other positively charged amino acids do similar promotion of aggregation, as for example, lysine or some other ones you might think of?
Okay, so the question is, do any other amino acids do this? So there's a pretty profound paper written by Ellen Furst showing that polymers of each of the 20 amino acids in the ideal biochemical environment can form beautiful cross beta sheet fibrils. Okay, there's polyalanine ataxias. And if you look at, for example, the yeast or the mammalian prion region, these are not pure glutamines, but they're polar rich. So you have stretches of asparagine and glutamine. I think you're asking an interesting question. What other regions of proteins under certain conditions could shift in conformation to become toxic? And we don't know the answer. Yes?
I wanted to ask you specifically about the prion diseases in yeast. So your model, I don't dispute your model in any way. I certainly could understand how protein homeostasis could be disrupted and facilitate the emergence of aggregated or aberrantly folded species. What I'm curious about, though, is we know with the yeast prions that a specific strain conformation is adapted when this happens, and it's maintained throughout generations upon generations and even through passage through in vitro and through other species. So I'm trying to fit that into just loss of the 70s or loss of the 90s. Or is it possible that some of the chaperones are playing a more active role in the conformation that's adopted of the aberrant conformation that's not just so spontaneous?
Let me try to reduce your question to
if
I agree, in yeast you can passage this, and some of our worms have been in continuous culture for years. It's about adaptation. So we've noticed as well that our worms change over time. As you might expect, that the idea of expressing something toxic chronically, if you're a worm, you have to be stupid to do this. Right? So why not let evolution and selection detoxify? So what happens is we still get aggregates, but they become much less toxic, as if we've kicked in some other genetic program that now has rebalanced the system. We don't know what that genetic program is. What we tend to do is just remake our lines, and then we restore toxicity immediately. But an interesting question would be to figure out what's the suppressor that allows adaptation. And you know, it certainly could be selective chaperones. It could be unrelated to chaperones. It could be a shift from the toxic species into larger, less toxic aggregates, right?
Hey, Rick, thank you again. And as a final request and reminder, there'll be refreshments back in the usual area, but they won't be served until Rick arrives, so please cooperate in letting him get there. Thank you.
I just love this tradition.
Good to see you. You too.
Well, thank you. Thank you.